teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Welcome to another edition of Education Matters. I was again tasked to go through the archives and find an episode that would be appropriate this morning, and I found one from June 9th, 2012, 3 years ago, with former Education Matters host Sandy Jacoby. She interviews author Jesse Klein about her book, The Bully Society.
I'd like to note that your book is not only grounded in your extensive research as an assistant professor of sociology and criminal justice at Adelphi University there in New York, but for me, as a high school educator of 38 years, your book is also informed, more importantly, by your work in schools for over 20 years. With those 20 years spent as a school counselor, a supervisor, a school social worker, substance abuse prevention counselor, a conflict resolution coordinator, and a social studies teacher, could you please share with us for just a few minutes how that school experience strengthens your view that the conditions that have sparked school shootings are the norm in our schools?
Yes, absolutely, and thank you for having me. I've worked in a number of different schools, all different kind of demographics, upper class, middle class, you know, people are having a very hard time. And I found in almost every school, whether people were very wealthy or having a hard time, these kinds of dynamics where people were not treating each other well. As a conflict resolution coordinator, I was often helping resolve conflicts, you know, sometimes very serious ones between gang leaders, sometimes more minor ones between a teacher and a student about whether, you know, the child should have worn a hat, you know, all kinds of different issues. But what I saw consistently was that there was just a lack of respect in the school and a lack of community repeatedly. And the other, you know, so that was much of my experience, was seeing that and working very hard to help students, help teachers, help parents, you know, care about one another and support one another and find ways to, you know, resolve their conflicts in constructive ways. But I also worked at a progressive public school for 5 years called Humanities Preparatory Academy, which was completely focused on creating community. And there I saw tremendous miracles. One of my students actually became very famous, Liz Murray, who wrote a book, From Homeless to Harvard. She went to Harvard University, and she'd been homeless. And many of my students had come from similarly, you know, devastating backgrounds. And because of the community in the school, they helped one another with their college applications. They supported one another through all kinds of difficult situations. And I got 100% of them into four-year colleges and 33% with full scholarships to private universities. You know, things that people just would never have expected from, you know, kids who are coming from very serious child abuse, domestic violence, homelessness, you know, drug-ridden neighborhoods. You know, the kids people just expected to not do well.
Those are very impressive statistics.
Yeah,
very.
So I've really seen miracles happen when schools create community. You know, and it's true, I think my experience really does reflect the research that community, building community is really effective in trying to prevent school bullying, and not just prevent it, but actually, you know, help students thrive and find their potential.
Okay, well then, you know, that sounds like you're really on target here from personal experience as well as your research at a later point. And I do want to say that your book is richly layered and textured with statistics and interviews, which, you know, I found amazing. But I want to talk for a few minutes first about school shootings, because to me it seems as if, you know, that these numbers, the news reports, kind of come at us rather sporadically across the three decades that you examine in your book. And so to me, the death toll and the injured toll that you've recorded in your book, those sheer numbers, I found those shocking. Only when reviewing the numbers does the impact of the bully culture appear so devastating. And so I'm asking, you know, if you could, would you kind of review some of those numbers if you have them accessible at your thoughts?
I do, actually. And if you you know, anybody could see that my research and data on my website, jessiekline.com, and right in the right-hand corner it says school shooting staff, and you can, you know, access my entire chart. And there I have 191 school shootings that took place between 1979 and 2011,
wow.
And quotes from each of the perpetrators as to why they committed their shootings when it was available. There were a few shootings where the motives were never revealed, but where possible, it is there. So what's very disturbing is that you can see how the shootings increased from decade to decade. From 1979 to 1988, there were 27. In the following decade, there were 55, almost doubled. They continued to increase to 66 in the third decade from 1999 to 2008. And if things go at the same pace, then there'll be, the number of shootings in the fourth decade will have equaled or just about equaled the number in the previous three decades combined. Now,
wow.
I didn't only chronicles what's called rampages, where kids, you know, attacked and targeted, you know, huge numbers of people. I charted any shooting that took place in a school, whether it was directed at one person or directed at many people. But it is terrifying, the
right.
amount of them that related to school bullying, and also issues related to gender. Much of my book is about how kids are basically dealing with a gender police in their schools, that they constantly monitor themselves and other kids as to whether they're being a proper boy or proper girl. And, you know, especially regarding masculinity, you know, boys who are more academic or boys who are skinny as opposed to more athletic, you know, are often teased and likened to either girls or homosexuals. And many of the school shooters actually said that they were attacking other boys who called them gay.
Oh, absolutely.
So again, on my website,
right.
you can see,
right.
You know, there are about a little more than 20% of the shootings were directed at girls. You know, there's a theme of violence against girls. There was a theme of domestic violence in the university shootings, as well as dating violence, about 15% of them. Masculinity challenges more generally, just about 50% of the shootings related to, you know, a boy feeling like he had to defend himself through violence or he was going to, you know, get called names, you know, gay or faggot or that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then you also see that there are shootings increasing in increasing numbers by girls, and the same gender issues are coming up where girls targeted other girls who called them gay or called them slut. You know, the same issues related to you're not girl enough or you're not boy enough.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about the gender policing that you've just mentioned, because obviously you point out in your book that this is one of the first of three current school culture traits. And so I'd
right.
like you to just develop that just a bit more about the gender policing as such.
Well, so what I did was I really looked at school shootings as a window into what's going on in schools more generally, because what I found is that when you see what the school shooters said was the reason for their shooting, many of them again said, you know, I attacked boys who called me gay, or I attacked girls who rejected me. And that's what led me to write the book in the first place, that when I started looking at shootings in, let's see, it was 1997, 1998, you just saw these kinds of patterns over and over again, every single shooting, and that continued, you know, through the present. So what I found then when I started interviewing people about school bullying, parents, teachers, students, is that they were complaining about exactly the same culture, that kids were, you know, being attacked, called gay almost every day, girls were getting called slut every day, you know, and that students had basically just gotten used to it, that there's a culture of harassment in most schools. And, you know, when I've talked to students even at the university about whether, you know, how they imagine this could change and what it would look like to have a school that was more focused on community where there wasn't bullying, you know, many of them just didn't even want to think about it. They were so used to it, they were so resigned to it, that it almost irritated them to imagine that it could be any different. And many of them had stopped calling it bullying or stopped calling it violence because they were just so used to it. And, you know, perhaps in seventh and eighth grade, when people tend to say it's worse, they were more hurt by it and more upset. But by high school, many of them had developed a thick skin, which again is part of my concern about what kids are taught. They're taught to be resilient. They're taught to have a tough skin and to just deal with things, as opposed to
right.
helping a school really create a culture where this is not acceptable behavior. And so it really saddened me how much students felt like this is just the culture and that they have to deal with it, and that it's not even worth talking about how to change it. It's just a matter of, you know, dealing with it, you know.
Well, let me ask you about those schools as such that you're mentioning that these kids are, you know, toughening themselves to be in for the, you know, that turn around and become the site for these shootings.
Right.
Your book actually reviews that the mass shootings occurred in predominantly white, middle-class, or upper-class suburbs or small towns. And I guess I would say, I think for most of us in reflecting on that, that's kind of surprising. Why do you think that's the typical setting for the kinds of behaviors that you're describing here and for shootings to occur?
Well, I have to say that I did see school shootings across all demographics, you know, rural, suburban, urban, again, you know, very poor, very wealthy, but just many of the rampages where there were attacks on multiple people were in wealthier areas, but again, some of them were in poorer areas as well. I think there is a culture, there's a very interesting book called The Price of Privilege by Madeline Levine, who is a psychologist, and I think she speaks to that issue of how, you know, kids are who are more wealthy are in a increased risk for anxiety and depression because there's just so much pressure on them to perform. And the whole notion that I talk about in terms of creating community where students feel accepted and supported is often even more absent in wealthier schools because kids are only getting credit, you know, as a person if they're excellent in school or they're excellent in sports or they're excellent, you know, in so many different barometers if they're popular, that kind of thing. Additionally, in wealthier schools, there's even more pressure to buy certain brands in order to be acceptable, and they're often very expensive, Louis Vuitton or Prada or certain kinds of watches or certain kinds of cars, and students who don't have that those kinds of status items are often harassed as well and called gay for not being able to purchase the items that associate them with powerful masculinity or you know, sexy femininity. So I think that, again, takes place in almost all schools, but it's more extreme and palpable in wealthier schools.
And so what you're saying then is that these masculinity imperatives and these symbols, that status symbols that come to be part of that in terms of the gay bashing and the, you know, the slut bashing of the girls, that those are linked, tied in closely to the gender policing, correct? Am I hearing you correctly on that? That
yes,
the masculinity imperatives. Can you maybe develop a little bit more about what you would identify as these masculinity imperatives?
Sure. Yeah, there are kids, you know, who in many schools, not all schools, depending on the school, but there are many schools where a boy who does academically well is often teased. They're expected to be athletic but not excel academically. And there's a lot of research about how kids underperform in order to be accepted as a male, you know, accepted as a boy in their schools.
How very sad.
Yeah, it's very sad, and it's very common. And many of the school shooters, actually, if you look at the chart, you'll see, you know, a portion of them were honor students. Many of them were, you know, had great computer savvy, or, you know, they had, you know, particularly excellent grades, and they, you know, were teased and harassed because of their academic excellence. There were also, you know, school shooters who said that they were teased because they were nice to girls, you know, in a culture where boys are expected to, you know, talk in a more cavalier way about their sexual experiences with girls, to make things up, to brag, you know, to be, you know, in that culture, to be respectful and kind can, you know, cause people to harass you and call you gay and such. So,
to perceive,
you know,
as weak.
Found, yeah.
To be perceived as weak.
Exactly, as seen as weak. That we're, you know, what I talk about is how their kids are expected to have, you know, what I call a flamboyant heterosexuality. You know, people are often giving people a hard time for, you know, what they call flamboyant homosexuality. But there's really a cultural norm in many schools where kids are expected to prove their heterosexuality every single day and in as visible a way as possible, which is why I think many boys feel like they actually have to make things up about what they've done with girls if they hadn't done anything that they could brag about. And the notion that you should be respectful and caring and loving towards somebody that you might be sexual with is not the most, you're not likely to make you a popular person, right? There's more of a pressure to be cavalier and callous about your sexuality. And interestingly, you know, there are books coming out about how girls feel the same pressure to be similarly callous. A book called Hooking Up, you know, also by NYU Press, published by NYU Press, which talks about how this culture is pretty common among both boys and girls today.
In terms of the masculine imperatives being sought out by both boys and girls in school.
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, in earlier times, there was this hope that as girls, women got more influential in business and you know, more influential in powerful positions in society more generally, that one, the society was going to become more empathic, and two, you know, relationships were going to be more focused on empathy as opposed to sexuality. And instead, what I found in my research is that, you know, as we've become even more competitive in our society, we've dismantled many social programs, which were sort of the emblem of compassion in our society. There's been just pressure for women to be just as cavalier as men, for women to be just as hyper-competitive and focused on succeeding without being concerned for others. And so instead of men becoming more empathic and more relationship-oriented, women have become less empathic and less relationship-oriented. So the notion that masculinity is a value for both men and women is what I try to communicate in the book as a problem. That obviously it's not a problem to be masculine generally, but that most men and women have a continuum of masculine and feminine ways to express themselves, and that what quote-unquote feminine ways of being empathic or relationship-oriented have been seriously discouraged in the last few decades.
So we have somewhat cut off that opportunity for young men to explore perhaps their more feminine sides, and at the same time geared up and promoted young women to adopt more masculine imperatives within their own personalities in order to be successful within this bully culture that we have.
That's exactly what I found. And, you know, many girls will tell you about what they experience in schools, where if somebody harasses them, they're really expected to fight. They're expected to use violence, too, and that they get, you know, harassed if you know, they back down in any way. One student in my school, my students come from suburban backgrounds, but she said, you know, this one girl, nobody knew her one day, and the next day, you know, she had pushed somebody down the stairs, and everybody, you know, knew her and thought highly of her, that often aggression and dominance and violence is, you know, considered something that people look up to, that you're a powerful person and therefore, you know, worthy of status.
A key to popularity, exactly.
Uh-huh. You know, and again, I think schools could do a lot to change that. I mean, I think often schools feel like, you know, we're not in charge of the emotional life of students. We just want to impart knowledge. But really, you know, I think schools could do a tremendous amount to help students become compassionate leaders, you know, and that if they don't take on this responsibility, we're going to continue in this direction where school shootings are increasing and the bully culture is normalized and, you know, students have to go to school in these hostile environments. And instead, you know, a school could create a community where students feel supported by one another, where they're encouraged to help one another, and you could really find students thriving and being caring and creating a much kinder world.
So in this normalized bully state that you just mentioned, this is an item you list in your book as a third school culture trait in those circumstances of these arenas of violence. You're saying that affects both not only the victims, but it also affects the bullies themselves, correct?
Yes, I think it's no good for anyone. I mean, this all occurs amidst some very disturbing statistics that since the 1980s, social isolation has tripled. So 25% of our population have nobody that they confide in. You know, 50% have maybe one person or nobody. There's another book, you know, that I reference in the Bully Society called The Lonely American, which addresses these issues. Depression and anxiety rates have soared. You know, most people, if they're not on antidepressants, they know somebody on antidepressants. You know, there's a culture of despair, I think, not only among students, but among adults. Kids are getting depressed at much younger ages. Anxiety is considered, you know, fairly normal. There's another statistic fascinating that your average kid today, if you saw the average kid today in the 1950s, they would be committed to a psychiatric hospital, you know, given the level of anxiety that they have. But in the 1950s, that level of anxiety that we just consider the way people are, you know, they're dealing with exams, they're dealing with, you know, different kinds of pressures, wasn't so normal in the 1950s. People would say, oh my gosh, we're really concerned about you and we need to get you help. But today, it's just considered normal. You know, I've seen advertisements for kids as young as 7 years old to get anti-anxiety medication.
Wow.
So then I think it's in, yeah.
So then how do the adults that are part of these kids' lives how do they become complicit in this normalizing of bullying and this excess of depression and that type of an atmosphere, anxious, motivated by rage kind of kids? I mean, how do the adults themselves become complicit in that? Are these like principals, teachers, parents?
I wouldn't say complicit specifically. I would say more that our economic and cultural and political and social system has become so focused on being competitive and being successful at all costs that adults also have taken that on, and that it's hard for kids. Kids find often they have no one to turn to because the adults in their lives are just as stressed out and having just as difficult a time as they are. And again, in the Bully Society, I talk about these books called the Overworked American and the Overspent American. There are all kinds of books coming out in the last few decades about how stressed out, grown-ups are, as well as a huge number of books about the anxiety and pressures that students are under. So I think what has happened is that because our culture has become so focused on competition and success and so, has unfortunately really under prioritized compassion and social programs that support people, both adults and students are pressured to feel that they have to do everything by themselves. And kids are often told when things happen that they have to learn to stand up for themselves, that they have to, develop their self-esteem. It's all about the individual. Many of the films about school bullying, you see the victim finally standing up to the bully and telling them off and, in front of a crowded, classroom or cafeteria. There's very little even imagination about how you create community where it's not about telling somebody off or just doing something on your own, but if anybody in your community is having a hard time, it's everybody's responsibility to be there for them and to support them. And I feel like, when you see the cyberbullying where, kids are saying these horrendous things about one another and then, they've sometimes even committed suicide, you see other kids, coming on the site and saying, well, I'm glad that you did that,
wow.
These horrible things, right? You could imagine a school intervening at a much earlier point and saying, look, somebody is being harassed, on the internet and they're a member of our community. Whether that person who's harassing them is from our community or not, let's do what we can to help this person feel cared about and supported. And so unfortunately, instead, I think most schools try to, they use all their resources to try to figure out who did it and how we can punish the person who did it. In cyberbullying, you can't always figure out who did it. And if you just get rid of one bully after another in a school, by expelling them or suspending them, you're not going to change the culture. You're just going to keep getting rid of one individual or another.
Okay, Dr. Klein, before we go off on cyberbullying, and I really want that to be my next topic, let me just, case we have some listeners who tuned in late, let me just remind them that if you have joined us late here at Education Matters, that my guest is author Jesse Klein, who holds a PhD in sociology, a master's in social work and a master's in education. Our conversation today focuses on her book, The Bully Society, and right now we are currently going to be talking about a little bit more about the cyberbullying aspect, because I found that fascinating. You've introduced that topic here in conversation, and I'm wondering, do you know how many or what percentage of children have been subjected to cyberbullying? Why has it intensified to such a great extent? And I guess I'm sitting here thinking, I wonder why the adults in their lives, you mentioned that the principals, teachers, parents being involved, why don't they just simply turn off the internet or turn off the cell phone, if they're getting this? So can you address a few of those? Like, what percentage of kids are coping with this?
I think it's an important question. And what I really try to do when I talk about school bullying is make it less about specifically how many kids are bullied, because everybody has a different definition of that, and more about, well, how many kids are not being treated well. And I think almost every student would say that they've had an experience where somebody said something really cruel to them on the internet. And I think, if a school is really trying to create community and a caring environment, they should really address every single issue. Obviously there'd be a huge amount in the beginning, but it would get less and less if students realized that, this is not acceptable to treat each other badly, to do anything that might hurt somebody's feelings. Doesn't mean you have to have a whole town meeting, with the whole school about every incident, but there are different things you could do, conflict resolution or an I statement or anything to just say we take seriously, people's feelings and we want people to learn how to be caring individuals.
So you're talking about schools supporting parents in developing those skills, those techniques, right?
Well, and schools supporting students in
and
developing
students,
those,
of course,
those
of
techniques.
Course,
that whenever they find out anybody is being treated badly, whether in cyberspace or in their own building, that they should feel responsible about acting on it. You know, that we know also empathy has decreased significantly in the last few decades. In the Bully Society, I talk about a book called Born to Love, which addresses those issues of how empathy has decreased. You know, that schools really need to say, we have a responsibility to help our students become caring, compassionate individuals in a culture where, again, so many people are depressed, anxious, you know, lacking in empathy.
Right.
You know, this is what schools need to take on. So I think,
so you're
you know, it's not, yeah?
Well, so you're suggesting that a lot of what we see in our adult society, that's being mirrored with these young kids receiving the kind of cyberbullying that they do. You know, I was just, you know, in reading your book, it made me put together some other pieces of information. And I was reading recently that a lot of nameless commentators are simply poisoning online discussions on the web where companies like Starbucks or Chevron and even NPR, which we're enjoying being a part of, that they have to use outside companies or sites like the HuffingtonPost.com. They have to employ in-house moderating teams who review as many as 5 million comments every month just to clean up their comment boards in order to make those, you know, reasonable with the public. That these anonymous and angry trolls use name-calling, they use hate speech to express their political, racist, gender, religious rage with just no consequences. And I guess I'm wondering how in the world that probably impacts our youth that we need to have people spend $10 million on a company to clean up the comment board. Is that,
right,
do you see that as a tremendous influence for our youth in that kind of rage?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the nail on the head, honestly, is that, you know, the book is called The Bully Society, that it's not just about schools. You know, people think that school bullying is about adolescence and people grow out of it. But it's really an imminent aspect of our culture more generally, and that, you know, most adults, if you talk to most adults, you can usually find that they've been bullied at work as well, and there's a culture of bullying in many workplaces, and what you see in cyberspace is often, you know, the same despair that we see in the statistics, is that, you know, adults are having just as hard a time as students and are having just as difficult a time being able to communicate in respectful and constructive ways, because, you know, of course, you can disagree with someone without, you know, name-calling or you know, resorting to racist or sexist or heterosexist kinds of references the way you do see people
and
do
so,
on the Internet.
Right. And so what you're saying is that, you know, some people have chosen this anonymous status in order to just vent that rage, and that our kids are picking up on that too. And I think perhaps sometimes we as adults forget that we are mirroring a culture that our young people are picking up on. Indeed, you've written, I'm going to quote you here, schools are microcosms of American society where students are told that financial wealth and superficial gender markers are compulsory for social acceptance. And so we wind up with this influence on schools and a bully culture from within our society as a whole, right? Is that, am I taking that the direction you were going?
Absolutely. You know, and that, again, I don't blame adults necessarily, because I think adults are despairing just as much as students are, you know, if not more, because they had a hard time as students and then they had a hard time as adults too. But I think, you know, generally we need to do a lot of community building in our society more as a whole.
In
a larger sense. Yeah, workplaces really need to address this issue as well, that, you know, and there's a tremendous amount of absenteeism and all kinds of problems because of how people are treated at work and the despair and the depression and anxiety that comes from workplace bullying that you know, you see sometimes reflected in cyberspace.
Well,
so these issues that, yeah.
Let me, can I just throw one more kind of interesting,
sure.
Like I said, your book really stimulated some thinking on my part, and I'm going to be thinking about it long after this interview, I can assure you. But, you know, I noticed that a lot of attention from the media, like the Washington Post and NewYorker.com, that they have turned to several incidents involving Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney during his period at a private prep school, and I'm pretty sure you've noted that as well.
Sure.
One incident in particular identified Romney as cutting off a fellow student's hair while the screaming, weeping boy, who was at that time presumed to be gay, was held down forcefully by several other boys. And some columnists, like Roger Simon, have labeled that the incidents as, you know, these several incidents collectively, like the one I've described, as bullying, although Romney described these as just hijinks and pranks. And I guess I would ask, what is your response to the media attention as to using these kinds of incidents to assess an individual? And I guess I would also ask, what are your thoughts about these two different cultural views as they reflect the strict father family versus the nurturant parent that you write about in your book?
Well, they're two different questions, I think. I mean,
okay,
the whole issue about, you know, is this a prank or is this bullying? You know, it was the same question that came up in the Ravi case with Tyler Clemente's suicide. You know, Ravi was accused of
and just sentenced
and found guilty of, you know, spying on his roommate during a homosexual sexual encounter, and Clemente committed suicide following that. And, you know, Ravi's defense team tried to say that it was just a prank and he was just a stupid teenager, and, you know, the prosecution tried to argue this was really hateful, a hateful act. And I think there's almost always a conversation like this after some incident takes place, you know, after school shootings take place. There's often this discussion, was the student bullied or not? I'm not sure it's a helpful discussion because, you know, more often than not, a kid who commits a school shooting wasn't treated well. You know, how you define bullying specifically isn't always exactly the case, but usually there's some sense of a student being a social outcast, or, you know, not being included in social events, or, you know, somehow just being treated badly. And again, I think that's a cultural norm. And so, in, you know, the book is called The Bully Society, but I try to address the issue as not, you know, what do we call bullying and what do we call a prank? You know, if someone's being treated badly, and what you describe is obviously treating someone very badly, you know, you don't want to diminish it by calling it a prank. You want to say, you know, what could you do even today to address what you might have done at that point? You know, what could you do to create more compassion in your community? What could you do to even make amends to that person that you might have hurt?
Yeah, that's interesting.
The conversation should shift so that we're more concerned about, well, how can we create more compassion rather than is it bullying or is it not, and how should the person be punished?
You know, I find
how should they be labeled?
I find there are also hopeful signs out there, because I just read a recent little news blurb about the fact that a woman had contacted her classmates from California, and it had been 25 years since she had graduated from high school, and she basically contacted them to say, you know, I was bullied in school, but I want you to know I'm okay, and I survived this, and I'm doing well, and I want you to know I'm doing well, and I forgive you, essentially. And apparently she received over 800 apologies, and they had, and then they collectively gathered monies for her to return for a school reunion after a 25 years out of high school. So, you know, I think that really speaks to the what you're talking about, the fact that we have a choice.
To
choose a more compassionate response. And I was moved by that. Same time, I was a little concerned about, you know, this bullying incident in, you know, in any presidential candidate's background. I mean, you know, and I just wondered, you know, what your perspective, you know, on that. And like you said, in seeking a gentler, more compassionate approach, you know, how does that come through in this, you know, in these cultural views about the strict father family versus the nurturant parent? I mean, you've written a chapter that delved into that pretty extensively as a society. Can you explain
that? The book references the work by George Lakoff, who's a linguist, and he wrote a book called Moral Politics, where he suggested that the notion of a strict father is as a family model and a moral value system is more related to conservative politics, where people who are, you know, more likely to be conservative or perhaps Republican might be more likely to feel that if somebody does something wrong, they need to be punished, that there's a strict father sense of how you deal with moral problems, whereas the nurturant parent is generally more concerned about how do you create a more supportive society, how do you, you know, make amends, and that's perhaps more of a democratic or liberal perspective on politics. And so what one of the things I found in the book was that the United States tends towards a strict father model. You know, whether or not you're Democrat or Republican, there's this cultural notion that people should be punished, that, you know, schools have largely taken on the notion of zero tolerance as a response to what they call school bullying, which means often that if a student does anything that they consider wrong, they're going to suspend them or expel them, that they're going to take a tough stand on it. Right. And what I found, the chapter you're referring to is called America is from Mars, Europe is from Venus.
Yes, it is.
Because when I looked at how European countries were responding to the school shootings that took place in their, you know, areas, there were, first of all, much fewer shootings, but also they were much more focused on how do we create community. You know, let's get a flood of new social workers in, let's address race issues, you know, let's figure out how we can help not just the victim, but also the bully and the bystander and the student and the parent and the teacher. You know, there's a five-track method that came out of Norway that was, you know, shown to reduce bullying by 50% immediately.
That's tremendous.
Into all kinds of languages. Yeah, really exciting research.
Right.
So what I found was that the United States has been really focused on the punishment model, the way Lakoff described it, and, you know, that we might actually learn something from the way European countries are responding, because they're getting a lot more results. There's a very interesting report called Zero Tolerance, Zero Evidence. There's no evidence that the zero tolerance policies that we've implemented have any effect at all.
Interesting.
There's a tremendous amount of research about how community building does help reduce, not just reduce school bullying, but create, you know, schools where students can really thrive and find their potential.
Dr. Klein, what about the people who would say, shouldn't we consider the current economic crisis that is being played out in Europe as an indictment of those educational and economic systems instead of looking for a better model to reduce conflict and bullying for adults and kids, that we should be saying, well, that system doesn't work well? What would we say back to those people?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of what's happening in Europe is a result of globalization, and much of globalization is the influence of the United States as well. I mean, we're having a very hard time economically, and many of our problems have been sort of outsourced to other countries. I mean, I think, you know, you go to European countries and you'll see McDonald's and you'll see, you know, Burger King, you'll see a lot of the American institutions. I think, you know, it's not, you know, in some sense, it's not really as different as it used to be. But you do find that people in European countries are better taken care of, you know, that when they're elderly, they have support. When they're sick, you know, the government's there for them. When they have a child, you know, a parent can stay home and be with the child until, you know, sometimes they're 3 or 4 years old. You know, there are all kinds of ways that the countries there are just saying, you know, very clearly that family values are important to them, that they want to make sure that people, you know, are supported and are able to deal with, you know, the most important things to them.
So you're suggesting that we indeed should look there for a better model in terms of reducing conflict and bullying for both our adults in our culture and our kids, right?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that if, you know, few people would say that they aren't having a hard time with all these issues that in many European countries, you know, are just completely taken care of. You know, people have such a hard time here with health care. They have such a hard time when their parents become elderly. They have such a hard time when they have a child and, you know, so many, you know, both parents have to work and they have to get a babysitter. You know, all of these issues aren't issues there because, you know, there's so much more support.
Well, then,
and I think that's something we should learn from.
Well, then, with this thing of the common culture of despair that you're talking about, and really across the board, from you're talking from cradle to grave here, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
with all the issues you're mentioning, what should we be doing in our schools to stop this culture of shooting and despair? How should we transform our schools' cultures? What should we be doing in U.S. schools?
I think we need to focus on creating community as a primary value, that schools should have town meetings, what I call town meetings, which are all school meetings that students can lead themselves, where students can develop an agenda, you know, with the help of teachers and administrators to try to create more compassion in their schools. And most students will say that this is very important to them and that this is something that they would like to have in their schools. And even when they have, you know, one-day workshops, they're often, you know, gratified to have the one day where there's more compassion in their schools. So,
but
you know,
it needs to be continued, right, beyond a day. It needs to go on. It needs more life
exactly.
in terms
I mean,
of growing.
I think
culture?
I was very struck by how many students would say, you know, we had, say, a challenge day in our school one day, and for two weeks, you know, that they came in and helped us, you know, resolve our conflicts, and then people went back to normal and were kind of hostile to one another, but it was worth it to have at least those 2 weeks as a reprieve. So what could a school do if they systemically said, you know, we're going to work on creating community and making sure that people are caring and supportive to one another? I think, you know, miracles could happen, and students are not necessarily going to be sold right away, because most people are so accustomed to just dealing with the bully society and resigned to it. So it's not like everybody will just, you know, step up and say, yes, I want to change the school culture. But I think if you look at these statistics about the depression, the anxiety, the social isolation, and you actually create a community where students can bond with one another and bond with their teachers and create friendships that are not about how do I become popular and how do I get status, but actually about real, honest, authentic sharing with another human being and developing real friendships, I think students are going to be very excited about doing that, and teachers are going to be excited about doing that, because everyone is really in need of having those kinds of relationships. And so if a school is able to provide it, it may well be the only place that the adults as well as the students get that kind of support and get that kind of care.
Well,
again, I think miracles could happen if the school is able to try to do that.
Well, and Dr. Klein, I believe you're involved in a number of efforts where you will go into school districts and work with them in terms of originating and sustaining this type of culture, right?
Yeah, I've been talking to private schools, independent schools, as well as public schools, to communities of students, communities of teachers, communities of parents. I mean, interestingly, most of the workshops that I do, when people ask me to come, they're usually about one population or another, whereas I really think the most effective work is if a school would ask me to come and talk to the whole community.
That makes sense.
Because ultimately, yeah, we need students, teachers, parents, administrators all to be working together. And to think about, you know, with their own creativity, what could we do to make our school more compassionate?
So it becomes individualized.
It might be different for every school. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And research shows us, too, that there isn't really a one-size-fits-all community-building effort that's going to be effective, that, you know, the best strategies are for each community to figure out, you know, together, well, what would be best for us in terms of creating the kind of community that would be supportive.
Well, let's wrap up here today. As we close, I just want to share a note that Liz Murray, you mentioned that she was a former student, and she is obviously a noted author of, you know, Homeless to Harvard, and has worked as an inspirational speaker, that she reviewed your book, and she had this to say about it. The bully society is riveting and powerful. Klein uncovers the roots of depression, school shootings, and other despair in American schools, and offers brilliant, doable solutions. The bully society points the way for students and schools to develop their full potential. Well, let me close here by thanking you, Dr. Jesse Klein, for sharing your commitment to education and for making a case to change a culture of bullying to a more positive, nurturing experience for children. I also want to add that to learn more for our audience and to reflect on work locally to change bullying in the school culture, I want to remind you that you may find a link to purchase the Bully Society at our website at wgtd.org or at jessiklein.com. We also have provided a direct link to purchase at Amazon on our website. Then I want to close by thanking you, Dr. Klein, and by saying that I'm Sandy Jacoby, your host, thanking you for listening to Education Matters here on WGTD HD.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Eat, drink, and be merry. Succulent treats, sinful sweets, dashing and clashing nights, music and laughter. The Bristol Renaissance Fair is open weekends through Labor Day, located just west of I-94, near the state line.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning. I'm Jim McClure at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, with Dan Kaler, tour guide, who will explain what the summer solstice is and so many other things.
Well, the solstice means that this is basically the longest.